this week's program, we take a walk through The Fix on Colonial Philadelphia Furniture, a secret guide to cabinet makers' prices, a new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns profiles composer Charles Strauss, creator of the musical Annie, among many others. And we listen back to a feature on Independence Hall by Susan Lewis. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In the 18th century, colonial Philadelphia's cabinet-making trade was extensive and competitive, second only to London's in the British Empire. In 1772, local shop owners, or master cabinet-makers, published a secret 36-page book detailing the retail prices to be charged for specific mahogany and walnut furniture, as well as the wages to be paid to the skilled craftsmen who made the furniture. Although incomplete handwritten manuscripts remained, in 2003 a single surviving printed copy of the book was discovered. A new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art displays this book, along with furniture from the museum's permanent collection that corresponds to the guide's descriptions. I took a walk through the exhibition earlier this week and then spoke with Alexander Kirtley, the museum's Associate Curator of American Decorative Arts. Most museums are loath to put any kinds of prices near any of their artifacts, and I see that you've resisted the temptation here. What are the special secrets that this book reveals about the craft of furniture making in colonial Philadelphia?
Well, more than the price is the fact that the prices were fixed. The prices were set by the master cabinet makers, and it suggests a competitive climate among the cabinet makers in the 18th century in Philadelphia, and suggests a long-standing tradition of cabinet making such that there is a complexity and a competitiveness where the master cabinet makers decided that they needed to unite and fix the prices and suppress some of the competition. And the date of the price book is 1772. So the cabinet making community in Philadelphia was by that time about almost 100 years old. And of course, furniture making began almost the day that Penn founded Philadelphia and set foot on the soil, because they needed houses and they needed furniture to fill them. And they also found here in Philadelphia, in the region, a fabulous, fabulous commodity, wood, both a primary wood that looked exactly like mahogany to many eyes, and also just a plethora of, and an abundance, really, of secondary woods. Remember that England at this time, the continent, Ireland, were essentially bald.
From all that shipbuilding to go off and conquer other lands. Yeah.
From the shipbuilding, but also from furniture making. And one way that you can tell an English piece of furniture, if you didn't know anything about identifying wood, you could actually recognize an English drawer and distinguish it from an American-made drawer by the width of the side. You'll find very, very, very skinny, skinny, skinny sides, drawer sides in an English cabinet, and in an American cabinet you'll find them much more substantial, because they didn't have to wither the wood down to that narrow size, which of course takes labor.
Everything bigger in America, even in those days.
Not bigger, just sort of more
robust.
Exactly, comfortable.
So these fixed prices then, were they the lower level of what somebody could sell? I mean, presumably the great masters, the really skilled craftsmen, could sell at a higher price, or was this really a price guide that was abided by?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, as much as the price book tells us, there's so much that it does not tell us. And that is one of the suggestions in there. But it is believed and is understood that the most skilled cabinet makers did abide by this. In the gallery adjacent to this main gallery here in the Powell Room, we have the museum's very famous and celebrated suite or set of furniture from the Cadwaladers. There's an invoice dated October 13th, 1770, in which Thomas Affleck, a Scottish cabinet maker who was patronized by Philadelphia's best families, including John Penn, he charged the Cadwaladers in 1770 £5 each for two card tables in the rough with commode or serpentine, which are curved rails, difficult to do. And he charged them £5 each for these card tables. That price is exactly the price that's in the 1772 price book. So we do believe that even the best cabinet makers use this. Now, where there is a subjectiveness in this is that it at one point in the price book says any carving to exceed 25 shillings. So the question is, what does 25 shillings worth of carving look like? What does that look like? We don't really know, but we know that certainly the Cadwallader furniture has an excess of carving on it. We know that on Thomas Affleck's bill, a copy of which is in the gallery, you see at the bottom two charges to carvers, specialty carvers. Philadelphia is renowned and distinguished among the British colonial cities for having the largest concentration of specialty carvers, many of whom were trained in London, some of whom we don't know where their training came from, but they were all carving in a very flamboyant, excessive, rococo, sensuous, organic, sinuous style. And they came here and they adorned these very heavy Baroque architectonic pieces of furniture. And we know that they charged extra for their labor. They were specially chosen either by the cabinet maker or by the patron who may have had a preference for a particular carver's work.
Give us a context on what £5 in the 1770s would mean today. Were these craftsmen well off? Did they make a robust living from this?
We don't really know. There are numerous indicators on what £5 was worth in today. You can Google, what is it worth, and come up with six different ways of calculating what £5 was worth. The truth of the matter is that this is a barter economy. In 1770, 1772, pre-colonial Philadelphia, it's a barter economy. The pound was based on the exchange rate with London, the bills of exchange between Philadelphia and London. And that was not the same exchange rate as between Boston and London, New York and London, Williamsburg and London, Annapolis and London, Charleston and London, and Newport and London. Those are the big centers. So everybody had their own currency, and the prices were all different. The valuations were all different. So it's very difficult to say what £5 would buy. We don't have circulars from grocery stores to tell us what a gallon of milk costs. We don't know this. And because it was such a barter economy, it's very difficult to say what £5 cost. Now, to the second part of your question, was cabinet making a lucrative venture? No. I mean, they just got by. Master cabinet makers had an enormous investment required in capital, in finding a place of business. They often moved about the city. That was not by choice. That was by they were forced to. So their addresses changed quite often. This was not a lucrative field. It was something that the ones who really succeeded financially were those who invested in other, oftentimes related, but in other fields. For instance, they sold lumber. They were lumber merchants. They invested in nails or ironworks or real estate. I mean, they had to have other investments to really offset their maybe what their passion was, which was making furniture.
Give us some context on the quality and the workmanship that's in the pieces that are in this exhibition. Were Philadelphia craftsmen among the best in the world in the 1770s?
The city of Philadelphia was the second largest city in the British Empire, which is not to say that it was really rivaled London. I mean, London had about 10 times the population. However, it was a large, large city. It was a huge place of commerce. The port was busy. You had enormous wealth here in Philadelphia from the colonial standpoint. And here in Philadelphia, you do find the skill of the craftsmen, the level of their craftsmanship, the quality of it, and also their wealth being very high, very distinguished. And I mean, whether it's the best in colonial context in America is purely subjective. I think my colleagues in Boston or New York might have different opinions than I would.
So. But were we selling any of this furniture anywhere else? I mean, what made in Philadelphia, did it get exported? Did it get sent to other colonies? Did it get sent back to the mainland as it was then, back to Britain?
It did. It was certainly, Philadelphia had a regional, enormous regional impact. New Jersey, southeastern Pennsylvania, Delaware, the eastern shore of Maryland. But you also had the exportation, if you will, of the craftsmen themselves. So they would be trained in Philadelphia. You have Eliphalet Chapin, who was trained in Philadelphia, moves back to his hometown of Connecticut, where he plies his trade. You'll find very similar design of cabinet making in Connecticut that you will in Philadelphia. Also Baltimore. Baltimore is within the sphere of Philadelphia. The cabinet making tradition there didn't really start until about this period, until about 1770. And you have two Quaker cabinet makers who move there and really found the cabinet making community there. And that goes on through the first two decades of the 19th century, where Philadelphia craftsmen are moving to Baltimore to ply their trade.
And the styles are mostly derivative. There's nothing truly original happening here in terms of design, is there?
Well, actually, I would not necessarily say that, because while you find a high chest, such as we have here in the gallery, a walnut high chest, you would find a high chest in England. The vogue for high chest dies very quickly in 1730, 40 in London, where in Philadelphia it takes off and becomes its own really canvas of Philadelphia style.
Alexandra Kirtley, the Philadelphia Museum of Arts Associate Curator of American Decorative Arts. The Fix on Colonial Philadelphia Furniture, a secret guide to cabinet makers' prices, opens today and runs through next April at the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
This song's composer, Charles Strauss, was serenaded on his recent 80th birthday with a variation on that tune, We Love You, Charles, Oh Yes We Do. The occasion also celebrated the publication of his memoir, titled Put on a Happy Face, which came out earlier this week. Strauss is one of the few still working talents from Broadway's golden age. Besides Bye Bye Birdie, he wrote Applause, Golden Boy and Annie in a total of 30 shows, a number of which tried out in Philadelphia. But he's hardly one to have great man airs. In fact, he spilled lots of beans to Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns on a recent afternoon visit to his intensely air-conditioned studio.
Charles Strauss grew up on New York City's Upper West Side, believing his future lay in classical music. Instead, he wrote, in consideration of his chronically ill father and suicidal mother, songs like Put on a Happy Face. And here he is at age 80 with a huge body of Broadway shows behind him and a few yet to come. The answer to where he went wrong, or right, comes from an unlikely place, the famous Parisian composition teacher Nadia Boulanger, who also taught Aaron Copland and Philip Glass, but, Strauss says, was instrumental in making him a Broadway baby.
When you got to know her well, a very sensitive psychologist, and she asked me to play things I had written when I was younger. And I said, oh, my God, you don't want to hear these things. And she said, no, I'd like to. I said, well, yeah, but they're all so silly. I said, I was in love with a girl when I was 12 or something, and I wrote a song called Moon Over 83rd Street. She wanted to hear it. And she said to me, among other things, that I had a talent for light music. And she said, you know, Americans and Germans are very serious about music, but she said the French respect light music. So she built up a sense of who I was.
Perfect counterpoint was one of Madame Boulanger's priorities. You wonder if she ever envisioned Strauss using that training in a song about teenagers talking on the phone. But that's not where Strauss feels the strongest impact from his Paris years.
I think of things when I go for the second and third note. Boulanger would have encouraged me to not go to the same E flat because we've heard it before and there's a certain familiarity in the ear. And so I have a tendency to push my way and go for a higher or different note, you know. It's very hard to put into words. It's like a painter's stroke.
I speak from my heart and she understands. For me, this is something new. Too hard to believe, too good to be true.
That's John C. Reilly and Carol Lee Carmelo in a demo recording for Strauss's musicalization of the Ernest Borgnine film Marty, which will be produced in the next year, along with Strauss's stage treatment of The Night They Raided Minsky's. Even the most hardened Broadway pundits marvel at Strauss's ability to come back after flops, and he's had plenty, from Nick and Nora to Dance a Little Closer, which was nicknamed Close a Little Faster. It's his need to work, Strauss says, that often allows him to do his best in fraught situations. One instance was the Philadelphia tryout of Golden Boy starring Sammy Davis Jr. Everything seemed just fine until one day the show star decided to change, well, not everything, but close to it. Exhausted from writing so much new material, Strauss asked that Fiddler on the Roof composer Jerry Bock be brought in. Instead, he was told to write a Big Sammy number without the help of lyricist Lee Adams, who was tending to his sick wife, that would bring the entire show to its emotional climax. Strauss wrote the song No More. Reviews were good from, among others, Dr. Martin Luther King.
I ain't bowing down. I ain't bowing down. I ain't bowing down. Lord, you hear me? I ain't bowing down. I ain't bowing down no more.
So, did Sammy know best in asking for all those changes? Or does Strauss have a genius for making the best of a near impossible situation?
Well, I would say the second one has more truth to it. The both questions have truth in it. But Sammy was a microcosm of the whole world, whites and blacks, all within that head of his. He was like a bouncing rubber ball. He went everywhere and did everything and did anything to please you. And I can't even remember if he ever lost his temper. He got mad at me a couple of times because we had musical differences. But I would love to redo Golden Boy.
Strauss has sometimes been considered a lightweight, perhaps because he suffers from comparisons to trendier shows like Rent, whose composer Jonathan Larson was a student of his, and Spring Awakening.
I've never been considered number one choice to do a new show, because I think people think of me as pleasant and happy, and that's not part of today's world.
Or so some think. Misunderstanding Charles Strauss is common among those who don't appreciate the power of the light touch and the impact of directness. His music consistently has those qualities, which explains the kind of immediate popularity he has enjoyed, but for which he hasn't always been respected.
It's a hard knock life for us. It's a hard knock life for us.
Instead of treated,
we get tricks.
Instead of kisses,
we get kicks. It's a hard knock life.
Then somebody with imagination recontextualizes something Strauss has written, like hip-hop artist Jay-Z, who sampled a song from Annie that characterizes the plight of Depression-era orphans, with results like Hard Knock Life, which explodes with new meaning and relevance. An equally fascinating transformation came with a song that, in some circles, wore out its welcome ages ago, the Annie anthem Tomorrow. Strauss wasn't even aware that punk rock poet Patti Smith had included it in a New Year's concert only months after 9/11 as a rough-hewn anthem of hope for even darker times, and did so without changing a note or a word. Intentionally or not, Charles Strauss leaves room in his songs for performers to inhabit and maneuver. Could anybody have predicted that this innocent song would be so radically reinformed by history?
Come out.
Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns. He writes about Charles Strauss in tomorrow's paper. Strauss's memoir, Put on a Happy Face, is out now on the Union Square Press imprint. In the mid-1700s on Chestnut Street in Philadelphia, the colony of Pennsylvania built a Georgian-style statehouse for its three branches of government: a courtroom, a legislative chamber, and the executive offices for the governor of the colony. But this red brick building became famous not for governance, but for the acts of rebellion that took place within its walls. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us on a tour of Independence Hall.
In a world dominated by the British Empire, 18th century Philadelphia was a breeding ground for revolutionary ideas, and Independence Hall was the womb where the notion of a new government was incubated, nurtured, and given full form. The critical documents that shaped America were debated and adopted here: the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the new United States of America.
If any place can be looked upon as the birthplace of the United States, it's in the assembly room of Independence Hall.
Bob Grau is a park ranger with the National Park Service, which now operates Independence Hall and the blocks surrounding it as part of Independence National Park. He says that the construction of the Pennsylvania State House was started in 1732.
And they started to use the main part of the building in 1735. Then they added on to it the east and west wings and also the bell tower. So the entire structure was completed about 1752.
Philadelphia was also a convenient meeting place for the colonies. By May of 1775, tensions with England had escalated, and the Continental Congress met to discuss a letter of grievances they had sent to the king. Historian Kyle Farley, who runs Poor Richard's walking tours in Philadelphia, says that upon convening at the Pennsylvania State House, the colonial representatives faced two problems.
The king basically ignored their appeals, and secondly, war had already broken out in Concord and Lexington. So by the time of the Second Continental Congress, they're really inheriting a war that's already begun.
The members of the Continental Congress responded not as rebels, but as British citizens, says Grau.
But they were willing to fight for what they considered their natural rights within the British Empire. So the Congress did create an army, a navy, and a Marine Corps during the year 1775. But the idea of independence, that's slower to take place.
However, this idea of self-governance began to ignite among average citizens, fueled by the writings of Thomas Paine in his January 1776 publication, Common Sense.
Common Sense is probably the most influential document written during the entire period, more influential at the time than the Declaration of Independence.
And it sold about 250,000 copies. So as the year goes on of 1776, now the political leaders meeting here in Philadelphia are picking up on that.
By June of 1776, colonial representatives were openly debating the possibility of independence. Because the stakes were so high, the decision would have to be unanimous. Although there were initially not enough votes, the Congress appointed a committee to write a declaration, just in case. And the committee turned to Thomas Jefferson, who was known as a gifted writer, says Grau.
He was renting a room at a place owned by a man named Jacob Graff at 7th and Market Street. That was on the very outskirts of the city. So it was a quiet place for him, and he was able to do his writing, and it takes him about 2.5 weeks to do that.
After days of debate, the Congress declared independence from the British Crown on, not the 4th, but the 2nd of July.
John Adams wrote a letter to his wife Abigail. He predicted to her that in the future of the new country, July 2nd would be celebrated forever with fireworks, parades, shows, and picnics.
On Thursday, the 4th of July, the wording of the declaration was officially approved, and the draft was sent to the printer. The weekend slowed things down, as weekends tend to do. And so it wasn't until Monday, July 8th, that the State House bell summoned the public for the first reading of the Declaration of Independence. After winning the war with England, the 13 states struggled to coexist using the Articles of Confederation, but things weren't going well, says Kyle Farley.
13 states that have 13 different currencies, 13 different armies, 9 different navies, trade barriers against each other, so they're running into all these conflicts state versus state. The other problem that they're having with the Articles of the Confederation, the government can't tax the people, so there's no money. So the Barbary pirates rob American ships and hold them for ransom. They say to the federal government, give us this much money, you can have your ships back, and the federal government doesn't have any money.
In 1787, the Constitutional Convention adopted the new Constitution of the United States of America in the Assembly Room of this building, and for the last decade of the 18th century, this block was the site of the local, state, and national governments, says Farley.
So just imagine combining Philadelphia's City Hall with Harrisburg, with Washington, D.C., and cramming all of that into those tiny little buildings. That gives you a sense of, first of all, how important Philadelphia was at the end of the 18th century, but secondly, how much smaller these cities were and how much smaller the government was.
Around the turn of the 19th century, the nation's capital moved to Washington, D.C., and the state capital to Harrisburg because, says Farley, these rural areas were considered to be less corrupt than the cities, particularly a big city like Philadelphia. The building we visit today has been restored to reflect its 18th century significance, but it wasn't always protected, or for that matter, called Independence Hall, a nickname, says Grau, that was first used in 1824 when an old friend of George Washington's, the Marquis de Lafayette, came back to visit the city.
The people that were going to set up the celebration, one of them, in a letter, talks about having Lafayette speak in front of the Hall of Independence.
Independence Hall was put to various uses over the years. The second floor, once used for the governor's offices and entertaining, housed a portrait gallery and a natural history museum operated by Charles Wilson Peel, who also co-founded the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. In the 1850s, the Liberty Bell was put on display in the assembly room. With the establishment of the National Park in 1948, Independence Hall was set aside and restored. It contains period furniture and the original rising sun chair used by Washington and other presiding officers, as well as the Pennsylvania coat of arms in the Supreme Court chamber. In 1978, the United Nations named Independence Hall a World Heritage Site. Standing in the hallway just outside the first floor courtroom and the Legislative Assembly, it's easy to envision John Hancock, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and George Washington filing in the door and taking their seats. If they did show up today, they'd no doubt be impressed. Not just that the bricks and mortar are still standing, but that the nation they founded and the principles for which they risked everything live on today.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Starting this week and running through July and August, guided tours of Independence Hall will include both the first and second floors. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.